Welcome back. This is Lyon Goodman, your co-host with Robert Moore, really an illustrious figure in the men's movement. Robert is a Jungian analyst. He is the well-known author of the series of books King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, and then the sub-books, The King Within, The Warrior Within, The Magician Within, and The Lover Within. And he basically decoded the four archetypal foundations of masculinity. And this theory of masculinity became really the most prominent in men's international men's work and masculine psychology. Robert is recognized as one of the leading psychotherapists and consultants in men's issues. He's a distinguished service professor of psychology, psychoanalysis, and spirituality in the Graduate Center of the Chicago Theological Seminary, where he's the founding director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Spirituality and Wellness. He also has a private practice in Chicago. He is a training analyst at the Jung Institute of Chicago and many other roles. He is a consummate author. His most recent book is Facing the Dragon, Confronting Personal and Spiritual Grandiosity, and he'll be talking to us about that as well. Robert, welcome to the Ultimate Men's Summit. You are our wrap-up speaker. You are the bookend, as I was saying. We had Robert Bly at the beginning, you at the end, to complete our series of more than 90 speakers on men's issues. I'm so happy you're here.
Lyon, it's a great honor and privilege to be a part of this great event, and I might say that personally it's extremely exciting and encouraging for me to see this activity, this ferment, this enthusiasm, this interest in continuing the work that remains undone to help men optimize their personal and spiritual lives, and through that their family and community and their contributions to the world. So it's a wonderful occasion. I want to congratulate you and all the people who've worked together to make this event a success.
Thank you. Thank you. In my 30-some years of men's work, we have looked at, you know, initiation as so crucial to our work together. How do we initiate ourselves and each other into manhood? We've examined the old ways that tribal cultures initiated men. We've tried to figure out new ways of doing so, and it's all based on your work, yours among others, but your work has been predominant in looking at how does initiation happen, what's it for, why do we need it, and how did it get lost along the way. Would you start by talking about how you got involved in this work and this research?
Yes, I would like to begin there, Lyon, to give folks a personal perspective on why I happened to be involved in men's work around the world, because I didn't start out to do that. I want to just give two key dates, or at least time zones, which mark my beginnings in this work. I had begun as a Jungian psychologist doing research on the collective unconscious, trying to follow Jung and to continue his work and update his work in the world. And it was about 1986 when I made what I consider to be a psychoanalytic scientific discovery about the four archetypal systems that are the building blocks of the human self, and I'll talk about those in a little while. But I discovered in the course of that, I discovered the asymmetry in the male and female psyche. I began to understand that what I had discovered was the structural differences between male and females, and with reference to the archetypal systems underlying their personalities. And so that was a fascinating discovery, and I was working on trying to decode the structures of the unconscious and therefore the structures that influence our behavior. But I did not at that time conceive myself to be a psychologist of masculinity, nor did I have any interest at that time in predominantly becoming identified as a psychologist of masculinity. But it was in 1987 that my wife Margaret and I were on a long trip through Asia. There's one event that I wanted to share with your listeners that hammered home to me the importance of male initiation in the world today, or the lack thereof. And we were in Bombay, what is now known as Mumbai, and we were in a cab. We were driving down this particular street in a section of Bombay. And this cab driver said to Margaret and me, on this street there are thousands of women and children, and you can have any of them that you want. I thought that I had misunderstood him because of his accent, and I said, excuse me, I don't think I understood you. And he repeated his statement, because what we were seeing was thousands upon thousands of women and children who were being sold into sexual slavery on this particular street in Bombay. And it was as if, when I realized what he was saying, it was as if you had taken a white-hot poker and jammed it into my brain. Because suddenly, for the first time in my whole life, the horror of human evil really got beyond a theory. I'd studied the theory of evil for many years, but got beyond a theory and got to be a raw existential reality. And so that put me into, that was right at the time of the harmonic convergence, I think some of your listeners may remember, 1987. And I was, that was a psychological and spiritual and kind of crisis for me, because seeing the rawness of this evil, and it really dawned on me immediately right there that it was mainly males that were behind the abuse of power that was allowing this kind of travesty to occur. And so for the next few months, I was sort of reeling, trying to figure out, you know, this evil that I had seen with my own eyes, this was so stark that it really challenged me with regard to what was I going to do about that kind of thing in the world.
So men, instead of being protectors, were now either predators or merchants of other people's souls.
Yes, and just as a word today, the sexual slavery is worse now than it has been for a long, long time. But anyway, so that was a fiery shock, and from August to October, I was just in a kind of a psycho-spiritual crisis, trying to think, well, I have to respond to this some way. I remember one day I was driving back down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, and I was just praying, you know, I was saying, I don't know really what to do about this, but I hope anything that I can do, I will try to do. It had not occurred to me at that time until that time, it had not occurred to me that I needed to publicize the unique structure of the male psyche, which makes men so vulnerable to becoming abusers of power.
What was the first book that you published on that topic?
That was it was King Warrior Magician Lover, because what happened was, the way this developed was, I started giving a lot of lectures about the structure of the male psyche, the archetypal potentials of masculinity, and how they are the foundations for a positive masculinity. But if a man does not understand them, if he does not understand the significance of being male with regard to these archetypal powers, that he is very likely to abuse his power and to not put his power into the service of the larger community. And that's when I realized that something terrible had happened to the capacity of human beings to offer their young people a vision of maturity. So, but Robert Bly had heard some of these lectures of mine on audio tapes, and began to listen to them and began to draw on them in his work. And he called me shortly thereafter and asked me to come participate with him in one of his early men's conferences. And that was my first immersion into men's work. I really didn't know what to expect, but through Robert's encouragement, we published Douglas Gillette and I published these this 5-volume series to try to help men understand why there's a really a structural difference between men and women, how men and women are similar and how they are different, and why the asymmetry in men and women on the warrior and the lover polarity makes men very dangerous when they're young and they have not come, they've not been helped to mature spiritually and psychologically.
Well,
so anyway, that's how I got into this business, and I began to realize that it was a moral imperative for me to emphasize masculinity in my work, because all of the great hopes that human beings have for the world, all the great hopes for justice, all the great hopes for peace, all these great hopes for that Earth might be fair, that's really dependent, frankly, upon the redemption of masculinity, the salvaging of the great things about masculinity, and helping young men understand that it is a good thing to aspire to be an optimal man.
In your book, which is truly a seminal work for us as men doing our work, you identified the difference between boy psychology and man psychology. There's sort of the role of the boy, and if a boy gains power without being initiated, he becomes kind of a warped man. But why don't we start with what is the psychological structure of masculinity? What's the hard wiring underneath the board?
Now let me just start with the thing that the four powers which males and females share, and they are the king and queen. That's the royal power. There's the warrior powers, the warrior system. There's the magician system, and there's the lover system. In the psyche, what I discovered was that there are two basic tensions, two basic dialectical tensions in the psyche. There is a creative tension that has to be held between the royal part of the personality and the magician part. The magician part is the part that plays the prophet. The prophet, the sage, the wise one, has got to power. The use of power has got to be informed by the critique of power. It's got to be informed by the wisdom of civilization. So that tension has got to be held, a creative tension between the royal and the wisdom.
The royal being sort of the ones that at the center have the vision and are taking care of the whole, of taking care of the
right. The royal vision, the royal system. I'm going to go over briefly what is in these systems, but the royal system is the system for power and the stewardship of power. If one is immature, one is simply a narcissistic personality disorder. If one's royal energy is not matured, but at the highest levels of generativity and maturity, the royal power in a man or woman leads to what we know today in psychology as generativity. It's the capacity to will and act beyond the selfish motives of the ego. Act for the greater good. The magician forces in the psyche are those that govern death and rebirth, that govern the capacity for contemplation, the capacity for pattern recognition, the capacity to recognize the abuse of power when one sees it, the capacity to study and to become informed by the great traditions of wisdom of the human species. So there's that axis. The other axis is equally important. It's the axis between the warrior systems and the lover systems. The warrior systems are the systems which are required for boundary formation, for appropriate boundary formation, so that one doesn't become codependent. It enables the individual to focus, to become disciplined. It enables an individual to understand the values of honor and duty, and loyalty, fidelity. It is the system. The warrior system is the archetypal system underlying the authentic urge to serve and protect. So whenever police car door, you will see that we serve and protect. That's really an archetypal value of the warrior systems, whether it's a male or female. The lover systems are the systems that have to do with the healthy embodiment, the capacity for intimacy, the capacity to play, capacity to know the meaning and experience of joy. And so your commitment to the warrior has to be balanced by your capacity to love. And there's a tension, a creative tension, that has to be held between the lover parts of the personality and the warrior parts of the personality.
And I think it's pretty obvious that if those two are not connected, damage can occur.
Much damage occurs when those two are not held in creative, creative tension. And when I want to use that, when I say creative tension, I want you to think about really toning your muscles at the gym. Because you don't try to develop just one set of muscles. You try to develop them all so they can cooperate with each other in total health. So spiritually and psychologically, we have to create this creative tension in the personality between these four archetypal powers. Now let me tell you, so men and women are alike. They all have to balance these four archetypal powers. And but now there's one thing that statistically is different between the males and the females. And it exists on the lover-warrior axis. That is to say that males typically come into more warrior energy early in life. Females tend to come into their warrior more often later in life. And men do not come into their lover capacities very, very adequately early in life. Men usually take until the middle of life to really become mature in the lover, to have the opportunity to become mature in the lover. And so there's a life cycle asymmetry in men and women, if you're speaking statistically. And this explains something I want to make clear to your listeners. There's a principle in sociology, a scientific discovery of sociology that has not been, there's no evidence to disconfirm it. And that is that if you're going to be harmed, if you're traveling around the world, if you're going to be harmed by anyone through a violent act, the violence is highly probable that it be perpetrated by a young male. So it's very important for us to understand that young males have greater temptations toward the abuse of power and toward violence than young females. There is absolutely no scientific evidence that contradicts that. So if you want to understand why human culture has always put a lot of capital, social capital and spiritual capital, into developing systems of initiation for young men, they have known that for aeons. All human communities sought to do things which tried to soften impact of the urges, the archetypal powers of young men. And so you're not likely to be, society is not likely to fall because of the lack of young female initiation rituals, but young female initiation rituals are very important. All persons have to be initiated into adulthood. But with young males, it's critically important that you can maintain a society. And this is one of the things that should get our attention right now. Around the world, there are more young males that are not being adequately cared for world culture than ever before.
Yeah, including the million people we have in prison, the million young men we have in prison, and the children of war everywhere around the world, including children who are recruited into being child soldiers.
Recruited into being child soldiers. This is the kind of thing that if you think about it very much, as I have over the years, this is what keeps driving me to stay involved in trying to help men's work as long as I live. Because if you once understand the importance of loving kindness directed in the direction of young males so that they can be aided to develop into the wonderful creatures that they potentially can be, if you don't look at this situation in the world now about how little care going into the psycho-spiritual development of young males. This is the thing that really that was so much on my mind when I was writing that essay in the Archetype of Initiation book that I gave to the speech I gave to the Mankind Project. And at that time, I was very excited to know that the Mankind Project was trying to do work on masculine initiation, and I remain interested in that. But anyway, so
is an initiation needed into each of those archetypes? In other words, do we need an initiation into the warrior, one into the magician, one into the lover, and the other into the king, or will one initiation do?
One of the things that I've always tried to do in the men's work is to keep men from oversimplifying things.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So there's always a simple answer to everything that's wrong. So
damn, that's very disappointing, Robert.
Well, that's why I wanted. I've tried in this system of in these books to give kind of a operator's manual to the male psyche, and if I had my way in men's work, we would really have a integrated system of care for men that would see to it that each one of that there were four initiations that we helped men with. To bring them into optimal male wholeness. And now this is getting initiated into your heart initiation, into your capacity for forceful assertiveness, your capacity for understanding that no matter how many times people told you that you were stupid, that you have a responsibility to become a magician. You have a responsibility to become a wise man. And that you have a responsibility to become a generative man, worthy of the image of a royal figure. The archetype of fatherhood. See, in my view, there's no father archetype. It is the royal archetype of the king. The father and the mother are the king and queen at the deepest levels of the psyche. And so we need to have attention to each of these systems, these archetypal systems. And they all need to be brought under what I call the fifth element, and this is why your emphasis on spirituality in this conference is very important. Because throughout the ages, masculine initiation has been about confronting masculine grandiosity, trying to help young men through spiritual means learn to recognize that there are transpersonal commitments that they must make if they are to be a real man. A real man, one who is worthy of the name, is a man who has commitments that transcend the ego, which enable him to be a generative, loving, and just influence on the world.
Yeah, so this should be standard textbook for every young man in school in the world, really, to understand themselves and their own inner psyche, their own the structure of their own psyche, and what's required to achieve that.
Exactly,
adulthood,
I think
the maturity of adulthood.
And I think that men's work has got to steward that whole process because, you know, there are so many that have never even thought about there being a real difference between males and females. And we don't want to overemphasize the differences between males and females. But we do have to face that young males have very, very, very different needs than young females in terms of helping learn to operate the very sophisticated organism that they are. So I want to come back to your comment about prisons. I have long been very, very interested in men's work in prisons. And my work, I've been criticized to say it's too complicated, Robert. But if it is so complicated, why is it that illiterate men in prison can understand it very easily? Because my work is by this fourfold vision of masculinity has been used in a lot of prisons and is being used today among illiterate people. There's something in us that knows that once you bring these things to consciousness, men recognize these different forces and begin to have a moral sense about their need to steward them. So I think that the fact that we have got so many people incarcerated in this country is an indictment against us in terms of what we are doing with young males in our culture.
It really does show the lack of care that we have for their souls, doesn't it? I mean, we are our institutions.
Absolutely.
Our institutions are soulless in a sense that it makes men disposable. We can just throw them away. Yeah.
Well, and warehouse them for profit.
Let's come to this issue of boy psychology versus man psychology, because you make it very articulate in your book that an uninitiated masculine tends to fall into the boy side of each of those archetypes. Would you speak to that?
Yes, I'll be happy to. Actually, in the book, I talk about monster boy psychology because what is a monster? A monster is someone who is deformed. It's appropriate to be a boy when you're a boy. You're 6 years old or 12 years old. But if a man comes physically of age, and he is still psychologically a boy, then he is going to be a very, very bad parody of masculinity. What we have come to know as patriarchy and abusive masculinity and the rapist male culture is not masculinity. It is a parody of masculinity. It is a monster boy masculinity. And
when you talk about rape mentality, you're not just talking about of women or of men in prison, but also of the earth, our own mother.
Oh, listen, if you go really deeply into rape psychology, rape culture, uninitiated masculinity is at the heart of that. And you're never going to get rid of it without helping men with this problem. It was very disturbing to me recently. I became aware, I want to just put this out there, I became aware that not only has there been a problem with rape of young women in our American military throughout these theaters where we have our soldiers serving. But it's come out now recently that there's a rape culture in which young men are raped to dominate them in the units. This is not talked about much. We need to face the extent to which a rape culture exists.
Well, we have the IMF president who raped a young African Islamic woman. You know, it's like that's so typical. It's so archetypal.
That's the typical. Yeah, that's it. There it is. Powerful man, wealthy, rich, you know, big a candidate to run for president of France. And this is the kind of so-called man that has risen to high levels. But let me go back. Let me go back to that. To you know, I've been concerned about the lack of teachings such as we're talking about in this conference for police and the military. And I came very close some years ago to being able to speak to the commandant of the Marine Corps about the importance of having moral psychology of masculinity taught to the officer corps. This was right after the tailhook scandal. I don't know whether you remember that.
It was, yes, sure.
When a lot of female military officers were raped. And I had a meeting to speak with the commander of the Marine Corps about this problem in the military. And just as I was flying to Washington to meet with him, there was a rape of Marines in Okinawa committed a very terrible rape, and he had to leave to go to deal with that incident. That's just an indication of the remainder of the work that we need to do, because we need to help our military and our police understand that if they are really going to serve and protect, they have got to root out this rape culture wherever it is found.
So that's the boy side of the lover, right? So
right.
What's the in the boy side of the warrior?
Well, that's when you use force. When you use force to dominate that which should be treated with compassion and empathy. It's a lack of capacity for empathy.
So it's really being a sociopath or a psychopath that really can't feel the impact on the other person, right?
It does not have the capacity to empathize.
And we've been told in movies like The Corporation that corporations also can function as psychopathic entities.
Oh, absolutely. Predators. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And so this whole thing about, this is the heart of psycho-spiritual development. And this is true for men and women. I mean, to face the challenge of becoming an optimal woman or an optimal man. This is a big thing. This is initiation at its deepest level. But to face for everyone to face, women need to face how much is riding on this loving kindness that needs to be poured into the lives of young males as they develop, so that they never know a day when they do not understand the need for empathy.
So it takes empathic parents to raise an empathic child?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, or surrogate parents. You know, there are a lot of folks who in the men's work today who did not have empathic parents, but the men's work is providing a intercultural unity which helps them generate things that they did not generate in their families. So one of the things that's been very heartening to me is to see the kind of love and care that is embodied by men who have had very wounded family lives, very, very difficult family lives. But the men's work, I'm so thrilled that you're having this conference, because it is a tremendous, tremendously promising thing that from the embers of the early days of the men's movement, you're fanning a new flame here. And what I have to say is, one of the old guys in this work is the situation is more serious now than it was when in 1987, when I became so aware of the need.
And we're seeing whole institutions fall down. We're seeing a kind of corruption being exposed almost everywhere in the society, from the banksters who took our economy down to the corporations that are taking over genetic privacy of our crops to... It's really everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's global. So this problem is global, not just a United States problem. It's a worldwide problem. And the vanguard of men's work that you represent with this conference, it has to seed male consciousness around the world. What kind of a male is it that has to suppress women in order to feel okay? I mean, that kind of masculinity dominates vast numbers of people in the world. Anyone that thinks that we're going to have the kind of transformation on Earth that everyone hopes for without directly, I mean directly addressing this as a male issue, it's just completely misled. It will not happen without the transformation of masculine consciousness throughout the world. And men have got to lead that. You know, one of the things we ought to take some hope in, you know, there was someone that said some time ago, you know, males don't care. They don't really care about being good, but they do care about being men. And there's, in an odd way, that's hopeful, because if you have an accurate, adequate understanding of masculinity, it has to be a moral psychology of masculinity. There's got to be a sense of moral development built into your idea of masculinity, moral and interpersonal maturation.
You talk about how there's kind of a cold chaos, which can be a depressive nihilism, or a hot chaos, which can be the underground rage and anger coming out. And you said the first task is locating the center. Would you talk about that?
In the ancient world, and I'm indebted to the great historian of religion, Mircea Eliade, for this. In the ancient world, there was always an awareness of the need to connect with the center out there, the center with a capital C, center beyond the ego. And all pilgrimages throughout history have been pilgrimages to a place that represented symbolically the great center, the transpersonal center out there. This is why the practice of spirituality is so important for both men and women. Because men and women who do not have a sense of a transcendent center, a center that is beyond the ego, that carries higher values than the values of the ego, they become dangerous to themselves and others. Because that is a formula for malignant narcissism. Not have a sense of a transpersonal center beyond the I, which one is willing to always keep in mind. Carl Jung was the person who realized that this is a psycho-spiritual reality. The center out there, for example, a sacred mountain, you would make a pilgrimage to a sacred mountain, or if there was a holy tree, the tree of life, you would make a pilgrimage to the sacred tree of your particular area.
Something that was outside of you but greater than you. Something
that was outside of you and greater than you. And in all the different traditions, I give lectures sometimes where I show the slides of all the centers out there, the sacred mountains around the world, and the sacred trees, and the sacred stones. You may have seen pictures of the circumambulation of the Kaaba in Islam, where millions of people circumambulate the great stone in the Kaaba. But that's all symbolic of the capacity, the spiritual capacity, to become aware of a center that's beyond the ego and to always act in awareness of the presence of the center beyond the ego. That's what differentiates the narcissist from the person who's becoming optimal psychologically and spiritually.
Now, our culture has gotten so scattered in so many different directions with so many options, millions per day, options flowing in front of your eyeballs. We've sort of lost our center. So what happens if you don't have that center?
Well, then you get serial addictions. You may have heard of serial monogamy. Well, there are also serial addictions, because here's the deal. Without a connection with and a commitment to a transpersonal center beyond your ego, you're likely to be flooded constantly with these archetypal energies coming from the deep psyche. And you will likely become so flooded with those energies that you will be unable to keep from acting out. That is what I believe drives psychopathology and sociopathology. That is, we all have these God energies. I call them dragon energies. We got these dragon energies in the psyche. They are huge. They're beyond anything that's human-sized. And if we have a transpersonal center, and we have, because of that, we've got the capacity to transform these energies and turn them into creativity instead of destructiveness, we can channel these creative energies into building culture and building a world community. But as you see, there's so much of this archetypal energy coming in now all around the world, and look at where most of it's going. Most of it's going into violence. Last night I was looking at news reports of these cities in the Mideast which have been bombed into smithereens, and thinking of the enormity of the work that's going to take to rebuild after this violence, this war. So when you look at the amount of war going on right now, that is all flooding archetypal energy. And it's just epidemic around the world. The addiction. Go ahead, by me. All these things are the result of incapacity to regulate all these primal archetypal energies.
So if we have the hunger that comes from being disconnected, deep hunger, we're in the chaos, we don't have a spiritual center, so then we get the shiny object syndrome, right? Something out there looks like I need that in order to be filled.
You get the cult of celebrity, you get the cult of consumption, you get the idea of just war. I think it's important to protect. I think it's important to protect the weak against those who are not initiated. but I think that what we got to realize is we've got this vast global spiritual challenge, and I think it's the shift network. I like that, because we're coming up on a time when we're going to need to face the great initiation. That would be the initiation where we have enough human beings on the planet who are aware of the need for a transpersonal center, and aware of the need to bring their archetypal powers under a moral and ethical regulation. You probably heard years ago of the 100th monkey theory.
Yes.
I'll throw this in here. There's one thing that gives me a lot of hope scientifically right now, and that is systems theory. Because what systems theory has discovered is that if one individual in a system starts to functioning at a higher level of organization, then all the parts of that system will respond to that. It cannot avoid responding to it.
Right, so out of chaos can come a higher level of organization.
Absolutely. What we need to realize is that when you're working on optimizing your own function, your own system self, as I call it. If you're working on becoming psycho-spiritually optimized by becoming truly initiated and becoming a force in the consciousness revolution, that we don't have to have 100% of people change in order to change the whole world system. We don't have to have 50%. There's a lot of reason to believe that it does not take a very high percentage of shift in consciousness on the part of individuals to force a change in the whole systems. So that there's some real good reasons to hope that that if people really focus on mindfulness and on their own development psychologically and spiritually, and seek to find ways to pass it on generatively in the culture and community, there's hope. I'm not in despair. I'm not a despairing man. I think there's hope, but I don't think there's a long time. I think that we've got to understand that when you destroy whole cultures, it's a very hard thing to bring them back.
I agree. In this process of initiation, you talk about the starting with the lack, seeing the shiny object out there, and we get swayed by the false gold instead of the real gold. There is some real gold out there, and if we can connect with the real gold, we can actually start getting energy and energy transfer to our own inner gold.
Absolutely. The whatever people may think of Wayne Dyer, I appreciate his emphasis on the connection with the source, with a capital S, because the source is always present. I call it the great it. I call it the dragon within, or the great it with a capital I and a capital T, the great thing that you can't control by naming it. So that is always present. The question is, does one recognize the presence of the source, or the great presence with a capital P? Does one recognize that? Because if you don't recognize it, then you're going to feel awfully alone in your attempt to facilitate transformation. But what I believe is that you're never alone. There's these great forces that are always present that can be drawn upon if you are conscious enough to understand that they both exist and that they are there for to be a source for you and your transformative work.
Now, can someone do that alone, or does it require a community? The Buddha called it the Sangha. You talk about containment, having an adequate milieu that can help you channel the creative energy of that.
Well, look at it this way. You know, there are undoubtedly some some spiritual athletes and spiritual geniuses that might have the capacity to do that as individuals, but the nature of these forces, which have to be contained and channeled, are such that human beings have all in their wisdom sought to gather around where one or two are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. It is a social phenomenon. That is to say, you need a spiritual community of like commitments to work together on. Now, that should not be drawn too starkly. For example, in the Mankind Project, I've always pushed very hard for the Mankind Project to be all-inclusive of men of every race, of every gender preference, of every political persuasion, of every cultural background, so that we face that it is a species initiation that we're talking about, not just a particular tribal initiation. Tribal initiations have carried the weight for many, many centuries.
And they've gotten us in quite a bit of trouble, too, as tribe fights against tribe.
Yes, I started to say this, because what happens is that the tribe will maintain grandiosity. You know, you can have initiation within the tribe, but the tribe itself maintains its grandiosity.
Us against them and exclusivity.
Right. We have to have a post-tribal or a pan-tribal sense of initiation. And that's where I think the men's work has been, so far, has been trying to carry that pretty clearly and consciously. Once in a while, there will be a little slippage back to sort of a tribal vision in these men's groups. But for men's work internationally, I think that the most important thing is the post-tribal or pan-tribal approaches to initiation.
Well, it widens the tribe to include the whole Earth community, doesn't it? I mean,
yes, it's exactly.
All. That's not the just the human world, but the
no, absolutely, nature. Absolutely. Because I love the way you picked up quickly on that rape culture comment, and talked about the rape of the earth, because you can't separate these things. So in any case, what I have to say to the folk is that there's a tremendous amount of work yet to be done, and so it is wonderful that you're making these efforts to use the new technologies to keep this challenge before us. And I'm a person that believes that, for example, Lion, the work you and your colleagues are doing, this is not done. I know you're going to need to rest after this summit for a while.
At least a couple of days.
But then it's going to continue, and it's extremely encouraging for me to know about the work you're doing and to be a part of it.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's great to get your blessing, and we at the Shift Network are working with a pan-tribal group of leaders and creators to put together a new initiation workshop, a transformational workshop for men that will be rolling out in 2012, because we want to take the best of what's been done by all of the tribes, all of the men's groups out there.
I think that's wonderful.
And put it together into an actual physical, live, in-person workshop to give men an experience of all of these things, to initiate in all ways into this elderhood, into the mature masculine. So we are not resting. I'll tell you that we've got a lot of work to do.
More power to you, and I think it's important for us to use that 2012 date for a symbol of the possible transformation that can occur. And like I'm trying to tell people, look, you know, we need to be creating the post-apocalyptic spirituality. We need to be understanding that it's only those who are in resignation and despair who are going to see the world ending in 2012. There may be an ending of an old epoch. There may be an ending of an old age, an old aeon. But what is important is doing what we can to make an offering. That's what I think is so important. We need to all make our offering together, that there may be the possibility of a new aeon in which human beings might have much better chance of realizing their potential globally, worldwide, and that Earth indeed might be fair.
And again, we at the Shift Network are making our contribution with our project called Birth 2012, which is to have on December 22nd, 2012, a worldwide honoring of that new aeon. So we would love your support and your participation.
Well, in
that.
You've got it.
That's great. Just a few minutes left. I want to bring in the mantle of elder, that you talk about. You know, the fact that you are an elder in your life. I'm becoming an elder, as my father had. I want to honor him and say, you know, my father's sweatshirt said, "Hill? What hill? I didn't see any damn hill." So I'm starting to repeat his sweatshirt motto there. But what is it to accept the mantle of an elder?
Well, I think that first of all, you need to look at your life, and you need to do your shadow work. You need to look at the failures you've had. You need to look at the mistakes you've made. You need to think about all of those fathers and elders that you benefited from in the past. I think that one way we could say it is this. I've often said to men, don't keep whining about the fact that you did not have the men in your life that you needed. Try to spend your rest of your life trying to be the kind of men you wish you had had in your childhood. So I would say that after a man does his shadow work, he needs to face the commitment to be the kind of man that he wishes he had had in his life, to be that kind of man for younger men and other men around the world. So an elder, to be an elder implies a generative commitment to quote, not retiring, unquote.
And especially to mentor the younger men coming up,
especially
so badly need that mentoring.
Well, and simply, all men of every age, all males need love, an elder is going to have to realize that he's not going to be able to be chintzy. He's going to have to open his heart. He has to put his energies behind generating that kind of image of the man that we would hope to be. And that is, to carry that image of the fully optimal male is not something that one individual can carry alone. That's got to be a shared task. And that's one of the things that I've been pleased about the Mankind Project, and I always tease them in their imperfect efforts to do this kind of work. I think that we all just have to sign on to carry that burden imperfectly.
Beautiful. And let's mention the Mankind Project, one of our co-sponsors, mkp.org, and Robert, your own website, robertmoore-phd.com. And you have shared brilliantly as our elder here, and we're about to move into our ceremony called Honoring Our Fathers. So I want to give you the first opportunity to publicly honor your father, and not just your biological father, but the fathers, the lineages that you are a part of. Would you do that? Would you like to?
I'll be happy to. My father's name was Golden Franklin Moore. He was a wonderful man of ethical integrity, an educator, and it was his stand against the abuse of power that gave me the courage to be involved in men's work today.
Thank you. And do you want to say anything about your lineage, the other masculine teachers you've had that brought you here?
Yes, I've had many, many, including Merce Iliade, Robert Bly, the males in my family, more than I can ever hope to name, but I'm very grateful to them.
And let's not forget Carl Jung, who was such an important figure for so many of us.
Right, exactly. Yes, and all of the great folks that have contributed to psychological sophistication and insight.
So, Robert, it has been not only a pleasure but an honor to be here with you. And we're about to transition over with my co-host, Stephen Dynan, to a ceremony of honoring, which I hope everyone stays on for. Not only will we be honoring our fathers, but you can honor your father publicly and on the air. So stay tuned for that. And this will conclude our Ultimate Men's Summit, 10 days of over 90 speakers who have brought their wisdom and their insights and their ideas to us, a very rich library that will be there for many months to listen to. It's like sitting at the knee of 90 elders, who each of whom has a gift for us. So please,
thank you very much for doing this work, Lion, and I will be excited about continuing to participate with you.
Robert, thank you so much. And Stephen, would you come into the room and
I'm here. Thank you both for a deep dive in the last hour. Very beautiful.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Robert. We'll be talking to you again soon.
Okay, thank you, bud.
Bye now.